are live about a minute early from the scheduled time, but it's Monday, so we're late. That happens all the time. I just went out and gave my wife a kiss before I got started with the show. And she says, man, you're running late today. I said, Mondays are hard. Mondays, you got to catch up on the whole weekend, handle all the email boxes. I'll have like 400 real emails in it and 1,000 shitty ones that are meaningless and all that. So it happens. So if I can launch a minute early, I get try to catch back up. 1 minute of catching up is still 1 minute of catching up. What are you talking about today? Well, we're heading into the last week before Christmas week. Christmas week, we will have the Christmas special and some other things. Between Christmas and New Year's, we'll be doing rewinds. So this is the last full week until we come back in 2025. And I want to make it kind of like fun, easy discussion topics. I don't want to get anything deeply scientific. I'm sorry, those of you that love the blood and guts, but we're not going to dig into all the crazy shit going on around the world. It can all take a break, at least in my mind, for the rest of the year. I kind of advise you to do the same thing for your own sanity. As I said on Thursday during an expert council show, you can start out by ignoring the freaking drones in New Jersey, because the drones in New Jersey are just a distraction. Whenever the media is like, hey, look at this, you probably should look at something else if you're going to look at anything. What are we going to talk about today, though? We're going to talk about composting. And a little bit different of an angle than we've ever done before. We're going to talk about it as the core or the heart of your homestead. And it really is the heart of a homestead. It's really the core of a homestead. It is the linchpin that everything runs on. But I don't know if we've ever discussed it from that angle before. So what I've got a plan to do today is go over some of the top ways for composting that people have always done. Real quick overview on that. Not so much how, but what it is and what its advantages and disadvantages are. Then we're going to talk about using, real quick, we'll talk about using biochar to take composting to another level. Someone here already said something I really liked. Legacy Farm and Homestead said in a live chat, I'm excited for this one. My chickens are the heart of my composting system. I make biochar, mix it with their wood chips, and use that as bedding, and that makes excellent compost. Absolutely. I'm going to talk a little bit today about why putting biochar in your compost isn't just about ending up with better compost, but actually accelerating the entire composting process. I've been looking at a lot of research lately as I'm developing the biochar course with the exact same methods of composting and biochar in one and not in the other. And the one with the biochar actually breaks down more fully and more completely quicker. So it has other advantages. So we're going to hit that real quick. Then we're going to talk about integrating it into your daily life so that you don't have to think about it anymore. And then I'm going to give you kind of, well, how have you done that, Jack? People often will say to me when I say you should be doing this, or like, do you eat your own dog food? Do you actually take your own advice? Son of a bitch, but yes. Those always have to be people that must be very, very new to what we do here. I've been doing this 16 and a half years if you're new to the show. I've lived my life about as publicly as I'm comfortable with, probably more publicly than my wife is, because I believe if you are going to teach people, if you're going to influence people, if you're going to set an example, you should actually do it instead of talk about it and bullshit about it. So I've tried to actually put forth everything that I've done, both the successes and the failures, because failures happen and we don't learn if we're not willing to fail. I've often said, and people get really mad when I say this, but you have to be wrong to learn. If you were right, then you would already know the thing. So one way, either you were wrong and you believed something that wasn't true, or you were wrong and that you didn't know a thing that existed. So learning is that journey. Before we do that, let's go ahead and mention our sponsors of the day. Sponsor of the day number one today is Anton's Land of Biltongs. It's my grandson's outside and can't hear. He has officially requested Biltong for Christmas, and I need to get that ordered for him today, and hopefully it will be here in time. It should be. I don't think anybody who likes meat and loves especially salty or seasoned meats would be unhappy with the gift of Biltong and Dewars and all the other good stuff from Anton's for Christmas. I know if you send me Biltong for Christmas or for any reason at all, I'm going to be a happy guy. So consider giving it as a gift, but also consider, picking some up for yourself. It's pretty good stuff. When I order it for myself, I usually eat it under a blanket with a flashlight so nobody catches me. That way nobody asks for any because it's that good. As Anton says, life is too short for average. So check out Anton's Land of Biltong today. Another sponsor of ours who's just great to work with is Joel Riles, who, of course, is the owner of Fortress Canine, but he's also the creator of Canine Academy, where you can learn to train yourself to train your dog. you should definitely check out canineacademy.us. Be great if you use my links, but even if you don't, check it out anyway. You know, it's not really hard to train a dog. What it's hard to do is train a person to not do dumb things with dogs, even when they don't realize they're doing dumb things. In fact, that's the hardest part. People generally don't do dumb things on purpose. But if you don't know, and you say things like, but I want the dog to be a dog. Well, in some instances, you can kind of let a dog run, especially once it's trained and disciplined. Then you can let it be a dog. But a dog wants direction. A dog wants strong leadership. A dog wants to know what you want from the dog. You can do that through the three C's that I helped Joel develop to explain his training method. It really didn't change what he's been doing. We just came up with this way of explaining it where people could remember it. We create the condition. That's the first C that allows the dog to potentially fail. But we control that condition so that if the dog does fail, it's not catastrophic. The chicken gets chased, but he's not dead. You've got the dog on a leash, that type of thing. And immediately, not later, not after you take a picture of the dog all sad because he ate your garbage or whatever, you immediately correct the behavior. If that doesn't get done within seconds of the behavior, the dog's moved on. He doesn't know anymore. That will give you your fourth C, which is conditioning the response that you're looking for, the behavior that you're looking for. Remember, Joel also has a free course you can take called the Learning Library. With that, let's get into making compost or using compost is the heart or the core of your system. So what I want to start out with that about today is just that concept as a whole. Like, I think most people here probably do compost. Many of you guys have taken my composting course, and you're even using the information you learned. You've built a bioreactor or what have you. But is it like a thing apart, or is it integrated into the way that you do things on a daily basis? You know, I Nicole Sauce was here from one of my events, and we were talking about the haters that we get online over like global warming and shit. And it was like 6 o'clock in the morning, and I'm sitting there making us coffee, and I'm cleaning out the French press from the day before. I'm straining the coffee grinds so they're not overly wet and putting them in a case. Before most of these people are awake, I'm making compost. Right. And I didn't say that just to dunk on those people. It's more about like, but I didn't have to think about it. Just like, I mean, you get up in the morning, probably one of the things you do is make coffee. Another thing you probably do is brush your teeth. If you are a person that works out, maybe you work out in the morning, you take a walk, you get in your car, you go to work. Like all these things have become habits. They're habitual. They're just what you need to do to progress on in your life. And so if you don't actually integrate composting that way, you end up losing resources. So if you integrated compost to the point of this thing would make compost, so it doesn't go in the garbage, it goes in this other place, whatever that place is for you. I'll talk about mine in a minute. Then that just becomes habit. It becomes habitual. And all of a sudden your garbage, there's less of it and it never stinks, because anything that could stink probably can be composted in some way, shape, or form, or fed to dogs, which is actually another way of composting. Anything fed to an animal eventually comes out the other end. And we'll talk about some of that today, too. But the big thing is I try to teach everything I do through the permaculture lens. Like looking at this as a systems thinker and a permaculturist, while there are literally hundreds of permaculture principles, the best 12 known principles are from David Holmgren, who is the co-founder along with Bill Mollison back in the 70s of permaculture. And he came up with these 12 principles. And what I love about David's 12 principles is most of the other principles can be explained with one of the 12, so if we can simplify down, that's good. But they're very encompassing and they're very easy to understand. Of those 12, approximately 4 or a full third of them would directly apply to this way of looking at compost. The first one is catch and store energy. We usually show a solar panel and a battery for this, but you know, microorganisms are one of the most valuable things in your garden, so building up a colony of them is catching and storing energy, plus all the food that normal people throw away, and we're the crazy ones, right? They go into the garbage, go in the waste stream, contribute to methane, all of that stuff could be actually harvested as a resource, and that resource requires energy, and they are energy. So we're catching and storing energy. We're also producing no waste. Produce no waste is one of Holmgren's 12 primary principles. You can't produce waste when you literally are converting waste into a resource, which is what we're doing here. We obtain a yield. Compost is valuable. If you doubt me, go look at what a bag of shitty, dried out, lifeless, crappy compost costs at Home Depot or Lowe's. Go look at what a yard of compost costs at a massive composting facility where that compost is, it's probably better than what you get a bag, but it's not much. It's very rapidly made. It's not the highest quality thing, but it still has a value, probably in the neighborhood of about $40 to $50 a yard in most locations. Some places a lot more. But then go look at what really great compost sells for. There's people that will buy a small bag, a cubic foot of compost for $20, $30, $40 versus a yard for $40 or $30 or somewhere in the middle. And they're happy to do it because they know it's about the microorganisms, it's about the life, it's about the biology, it's not the NPK. Otherwise, because most commercial compost is just fill. It's organic fill. It's lifeless, it's poorly made, it's poorly treated. It is never something that's going to do a real good job if you make something like an extract or a tea out of it, and it still has value. So we are now obtaining a yield in that we have a resource we can use as a yield, or we can sell as a yield, or we can not buy it because we have it, and that's another form of a yield. And then, of course, use and value resources. So if we're taking the things that other people see as trash, we're transmitting them mentally into resources so that we value them. We won't discard them. We will make use of them and harness them. Hopefully that makes sense. That's why we're coming at this subject this way today. And thank you, Food Plant Nursery Brookville, for your endorsement of my courses. Thank you so much for that. I really appreciate that. Let's talk about composting, though. I've got a bunch of methods here. I think it's like 10 of them. But I want to start out with something. Like, my gold standard is bioreactor composting, and I'll save that one for last in this list. And I do think it gets the best result in the end, especially relative to the amount of total work done by the person doing the composting. And I think it actually connects well to many other smaller methods of composting that eventually end up in a bioreactor. But there really isn't a best method, because what is the two-word answer that I give more than any other answer to every question that's ever asked of me? It depends. So if you say, well, bioreactor composting is the way to go, and you have a person who lives in, like, maybe not an apartment, but a really small kind of like row house, townhouse or something, they've got a backyard about the size of my office. My office, I think, is 12 by 11. Maybe it's even double that size. There's just not that much room. There's little plants out in the front and the back and all. And all they have for waste is the waste that they produce from their kitchen. Well, they're never going to have the, you know, 2 yards-ish of waste material to make a single bioreactor with. That person would probably do fantastic with just a worm farm. So I want to go through all these methods so you can pick the one, or more more likely ones, that will work for you. The first is direct composting. This is where we take food waste, we go out to a garden or an orchard, we dig a trench, we throw the food in the trench just as it is and cover it up. Now, we might want to do some things like add some EM or something to that to speed up that process. But in the end, this works. If you put organic matter in the dirt where soil organisms are, they will break it down. They will grow. They will spring to life. They will multiply. And they'll do a great job for you. This can also be done with pits. I use a pit composting method. But when I say it here, it's really not the way I do a pit, where it's kind of off by itself. You can only have pits that are in the center of gardens. We can do, you know, worm towers, or even though there's worms involved, it's really a form of pit composting. We're putting the compost in the soil. We're never moving it again. These methods, that's what we're really talking about, direct composting. We don't move the material. Lasagna gardening. You can do lasagna gardening. You literally put down a whole layer of waste as one of your lasagna layers. It's another. We put the organic matter in place. We never touch it again. That's what makes it direct composting. This has some real advantages because there's one step. Whatever you do to get it in the dirt, and you're done. You never look at it again. The downside is you usually don't have enough to matter at one time. If it smells a certain way, you know, maybe dogs or something will dig it up on you. And it's kind of a one-time application. You have to keep going back with it to get lasting results. You can't make any kind of a tea or an extract out of it. It's not great for making, you know, potted plants or something like that. But it's a good baseline. And if you have a large enough waste stream, or occasionally have a big bursty waste stream that you can't really deal with any other way, it would be a good way to go. The next is conventional high-turn compost. This is what most people teach. It's also known as the Berkeley method. Some people say 21 days. Some people say 28 days. But the whole point with high-turn is the high-turn component. So we're going to look at a C to N ratio, or carbon-nitrogen ratio, somewhere like 80-20. Would be a really good place to start with. Sometimes you have more nitrogen, sometimes more carbon. But one way or another, we want to make sure there's enough nitrogen to go along with our carbon to create bonding and breakdown. We build up a big pile. We make it nice and wet. And about 4 days after we build the first pile, we turn it. And if we're doing it the way it's taught by people that really know what they're doing, we kind of peel the outside and make the outside the new core, and then take the core and stack it on the outside. And then every 2 to 3 days after that, we will turn it again and again and again. And somewhere in the 21st to 28th day, when you go to turn it, you'll look at it. It'll smell nice, and you really can't identify much of anything left in it. We've had this heat-based thermophilic breakdown, and everything, you know, kind of gets going and knocks that material down really, really fast, and that's great. There's the good of this is we get compost quickly. And if we're making compost, especially for resale, we can make a lot of compost really fast. It scales up well. We can use a piece of equipment. We can use a front end loader or a mini X or something to do all this turning if we have equipment. The downside is that compost will have very little fungi in it and a low diversity of bacteria when it's finished. At first, if you'll do what you should do, which is once you've made that compost, put it somewhere where it can get good airflow, it stays moist, it's not molested or messed with or turned again, and let it sit there somewhere between 4 to 8 weeks, 1 to 2 months minimum, and then use it, and your diversity of microorganisms will explode in it, and your fungi will begin to develop in it. And there's people that use this method, and they make very good compost. Billy Bond makes exceptional compost this way. There's nothing wrong with doing it, but in the end, I don't care if you get it done in a month. You're still a 90-day process to really 120 days to do it right. 120 days, you're approaching 180, right, which is half a year. Bioreactor takes a year, but we only touch it once, except to keep it wet and make sure we keep a wood chip cap on it. Or keep it covered with something, one way or the other. Vermicompost. The beauty of vermicompost is if you keep your worms somewhere that they don't get too cold or too hot, if you don't overfeed your worms and you keep them moist but not soaking wet, you almost can't mess it up. And you will make exceptional compost as an end product. Almost, if the worms stay alive and the nutrient gets processed, it's some of the best compost you'll ever get your hands on. It is rich in bacteria. It is going to be rich in microorganisms, extremely rich in all forms of microorganisms. It will have a significant amount of fungal activity in it. And what you're really looking at is a worm castings, which is what comes out the back end of the worm. Where the biggest problems come with worm composting is people think they're feeding worms. You are indirectly feeding worms. You're not directly feeding worms. When you take that tomato waste that's left over, like that one nasty tomato, and you just cut it in quarters and threw it in your worm farm, or those rinds off a melon, or you know, some brown leaves that you pick up and you throw in there as your carbon and kind of your dry materials to help pull some of the moisture up so it doesn't get too wet in one spot. Or anything that you add to it, you know, the coconut coir base that you started with, all that stuff from the nitrogens to the carbons and everything in between. And the one thing that doesn't really needs to not go in there is grass clippings. That is very likely to kick off a thermophilic cycle in your worm bin. You never want a thermophilic cycle in your worm bin. If you open your worm bin and it's hot, you need to do something. I can't tell you what to do because I don't know why. Did you get it too wet with too much nitrogen and carbon? Did you add a bunch of carbon when you shouldn't have? Did you get the carbon? I don't know. You have to figure out what you've done. Down to if you have to, you can actually break it apart and split it and put a bunch of dry carbon on top of it to pull some of the moisture out of it. But you've got to fix that. If you don't fix that, you're going to have real problems. As long as that doesn't happen, man, the compost you get out of there is amazing, and it's because this is what's really going on. The worms are manipulating and moving around and impregnating all that organic matter you're adding with microorganisms. And those microorganisms are what's actually breaking it down, and they do it way faster than you would typically find in, like, let's say, a turned compost pile, because it's so bioactive, it's broken down really quick. The worms are then eating both the waste of the microbes and the microbes themselves. There's another permaculture principle, everything gardens. That's a Mollisonian principle. That's one of Bill's principles. And everything gardens is, it could also be in this case, it's more like everything ranches, right? Everything gardens or ranches, because we usually think of ranching as like taking care of like cattle or sheep, you know, animals, right? Things that move around. And gardening, we usually think of as growing plants. Well, in this case, the worms are actually growing and cultivating microorganisms. Once you understand that, it's a much easier mental thing to maintain a worm farm. But the quality of worm castings for a biological enhancement is amazing. Worm tea, worm compost tea, worm compost extract, amazing. And adding it into other compost is also just an incredible kicker into those other forms of compost. Next is black soldier fly. I'll talk the least about this because I've only done it kind of just to mess around with, and I've kind of done it on accident a couple of times when I've let worm farms be invaded by BSLs. They're really easy to do. For all of the hoopla about these expensive bins and things like that, you can just take like a big, like 45-gallon Rubbermaid tub. You can make a little ramp in it, and you can put a hole in a thing out. And what happens is the black soldier flies come, they lay their eggs. The eggs turn into, you know, grubs or BSL, black soldier fly larvae. Essentially, they turn into maggots. They eat the food directly. They are not effing around. This is much quicker than worm compost. And what you are harvesting in a BSL bin, they call frost, right? Black soldier fly larva frost, because that sounds a lot better than black soldier fly maggot shit. But it's what it is. And what I have determined in talking to a lot of people that do this heavily is that probably the best thing you can do with that frost is add it to another compost before using it. It's not that it won't work well, but when it goes through a secondary process, it ends up with a much better end product and a lot less potential to have some things in there that are maybe pathogenic that you wouldn't want. Black soldier fry frost, then add it to a worm bin. And the worms break that frost down further to that next level of worm castings. That is probably some of the best compost you can ever get. It's also exceptional added to like a high turn pile. It's exceptional added to a static pile or a bioreactor or anything. But it's really better if you go to another level with it. I've used some compost tea made from frost, and it was good. But I have to say that it seemed to be a better product with less odoriferous issues when it was actually put through a secondary process. Like compost tea, aerated compost tea using soldier frost it stinks. And so to me, when something smells bad, it's probably not optimum for using on things that we're going to eat, if that makes sense. We need to get another level. Leaf mold composting. This is just really simple. This is getting a bunch of shredded brown leaves together with no real nitrogen involved at all. Making sure there's good airflow, and it will eventually begin to break down with microorganisms and leaf mold. And that's it. It's that simple. Now, again, so many of these methods end up kicked to another level if we combine them. So one way you might do that is if you're doing static pile, which we'll talk about in a minute, or bioreactors, which we'll talk about at the end, would be take that molded leaf product and cap your bioreactor with it, and then maybe a cap of wood chips, because now we've got even more indigenous microorganisms that we've captured locally. And once that thermophilic cycle, which is only going to run somewhere between 5 to 7 up to about 20 days, where you see that temperature really just plummet in that bioreactor, everything on the top is just going to start colonizing and going for it. So that's all there really is to leaf mold. It's just piling leaves up. You can use something like a hardware cloth made into a ring and just, you know, maybe go about 3 foot. You know, then you only got 18 inches from the sides. You're going to have plenty of airflow. With most compost, you really want to be 1 foot from a wall, an opening. But with leaf, it's so fluffy and light, you're going to get an easy 18 inches of penetration. And remember, we're not going thermophilic at all here. There might be some heat up from that. But in the end, just moist, shredded leaves, not packed, just piled into a pile and contained, will end up with great leaf mold compost. That, if you're going to stop at that, that stuff, mulching it is magic. Mulching well, you know, like halfway broke down leaf mold compost around things like tomatoes and peppers, especially right as they begin to flower, it's just magic what it does. But again, it goes really good added to another compost. As somebody is saying here, soldier fly frost is worm candy. Indeed, they go apeshit on it. I don't know if it's because there's so much microorganism in it that they're actually eating the microorganisms. I don't know if they actually eat that directly, unlike some of the other vegetative matter and things like that, but they do go pretty bonkers when you give that to them. One thing about soldier fly larvae before I go on, black soldier fly larvae, they are a maggot, but they are different than a housefly maggot. And one, they get bigger and they eat faster and all that. But the big difference is how the eggs are laid. A fly wants, a housefly wants to land on the food substance and it wants to lay eggs directly on it. And then those little maggots eat it, they turn into a fly, and they fly away. A black soldier fly does not want to lay eggs directly on the food. They want to lay it adjacent. So the best practice there is to get some corrugated cardboard, cut a bunch of layers of it, and kind of zip tie it all together so the end's exposed. So you've got all those little holes and honeycombs, and either hang that or kind of set it somewhere up on the top above the material that's actually being eaten. And this is why. Soldier fly larvae are freaking psychopaths of the soil or psychopaths of the breakdown cycle. They will eat anything. And so if you put an egg in there that's not moving, they'll eat the eggs of their brothers and sisters. If that larva pupates, there's a good chance it could get eaten because it's no longer moving around. Now it's dead. They might eat you, right? So they pupate and they crawl out. So it's important to give them a place to lay eggs and a way to get out because the pile itself is so crazy active. It's just mouths. And if you really want to like put in something like black soldier fly versus banana on YouTube and find a video, they show a time lapse of like just one day of a whole banana set in a BSL bin. It's insane the way these things go, where it would be there for weeks if you did that in a worm bin. All right, moving on. Let's talk about tumbler composting. I think tumbler composting is a fantastic thing. It has limits, but it's a decent way to go. There's some sort, you know, you'll either build something yourself, but the products built to do this are so inexpensive, you know, 75, 80 bucks. Most people just buy one. And so you have a tumbler. It's just a black bin. It's got some holes in it. You throw your waste in on a continuous waste stream. And every time you add waste to it, you kind of spin it around a bit and you want to make sure it doesn't dry out. That managing one, that's all there is to it. They make okay compost. The problem with a tumbler is that it's the cake problem is the way that Jeff Lawton puts it. So you're going to make a cake. So you make up enough batter to make a cake, a certain diameter, a certain thickness, but you only put like 10% of the batter in the pan. You stick the batter in the oven. Now the oven cooks the cake like 20% of the way it's supposed to be cooked, and you lay down another 10% of batter and you put the cake back in the oven. And you keep doing that till you get 100% of it. Well, you get a totally shitty cake. It's not that bad, but it's also not great. Tumbler compost is another thing you need to do that once you get to the end, you need to age it for at least a couple months. Because the last stuff you put in is not even broken down yet. So tumbler systems generally work better when there's like a two-tumbler system. So you got two tumblers, and you just keep filling one up until it's pretty much full. And then you start filling the second one up. And most people will find, just like my buckets or my garbage can system I built years ago, But by the time the second one is full, the first one's ready to use. So it's like a long process of the first batch, but then, you know, every couple, 3 months, you have one side full of usable compost. If you're not ready to use it, it makes a lot of sense to get it out of the tumbler, keep it moist, keep it in the shade, keep it well cared for, and let it age. Because compost is like wine, right? It just gets better with age. It almost can't get too old. As long as it's, so if you take wine, you put it in a really hot place, you store it with the lid up, so that the wine is not in contact with the cork, and it's a corked bottle. The cork will eventually dry out. The wine will end up letting air get in. It'll turn to vinegar, and you'll ruin it. Compost is kind of the same way. You let it dry out. It becomes hydrophobic. All the microorganisms encapsulate themselves and hope water comes back. If the water doesn't come back soon enough, a lot of them die. It's all bad news. But if you keep it moist, and you keep it at a decent temperature, and you keep it protected so it's not overly hit with sunlight or overly saturated with rain, you can keep compost for years, and it just keeps getting better. Moving on from tumbler, then that leaves us to static pile. Static pile is something that I see a lot of people do, and I don't like the way that they do it. Funny that, you know, here's Jack criticizing people again. I think what they're doing is fine, but the problem is they have one. And I think a static pile system, so a static pile means we never turn it, kind of like a bioreactor. It could even be a bioreactor. But instead of putting all the material in at one go, we put material in, and next day we have more material. And the next day we're doing the cake thing again, right? But we know what we're doing, so it's okay. Because we're going to fill whatever we're using to contain that compost, we're going to fill it to the top, and we're going to leave it alone. Just like the freaking tumbler system we just talked about, okay? My problem with most people's static pile compost is they fill the thing and they start taking from it. And then they keep adding to it and they keep taking it and they keep adding to it and they keep taking it and they keep adding to it and they keep taking it. Well, where are you taking your compost from? The top. Where's your newest material? The top. Where's your best material? Down the bottom. So I think the way you should do this is to size the bin to your waste stream so that it takes you about 4 to 6 months to fill up bin A before you start filling bin B. And then, you know, 2 months after that, you can start drawing from bin A. And by the time bin A is drawn down, you stop adding to B and you start adding back to A again. And we can always take some of that really great compost out of bin A at the end of that, and we can use it to seed our next batch. You might even have a three-bin system. But if you're not doing that with your bin, you end up in this perpetual thing where you're constantly, unless you develop some way to take from the bottom of it. And that would be an acceptable way too. But I think it's just much easier to have a multi-bin system. And you want to make sure you have good airflow through a static pile system, or you're going to get a lot of anaerobic breakdown. And anaerobes, with the exception of some that we know, like EM or effective microorganisms, purple non-sulfur bacteria, some other ones, we really don't want anaerobes. Bokashi is anaerobic, that's fine because we know what we're using and we're controlling it. When you pull a compost pile back apart, and I'm not talking like the first day when it's off-gassing and you smell ammonia because you pulled, you know, coop litter out that's just full of ammonia. Of course, you're going to smell some ammonia. But when it's like active and it's been running a while and there's a stink to it, that's anaerobes. And those are usually bad. So we don't want that to happen. So in our static pile, we want to make sure that we have good airflow. And again, you can do a static pile that looks an awful lot like a bioreactor. It is still a bioreactor. We're just doing it in a different way that we're adding the material. And honestly, once it's full, whether you do it all in one day or whether you fill it over time, the best practice is to let that go a year. Let that go a year. I also have something that I'm going to be adding to the bioreactor course as bonus content. And those of you who have taken the course and have never explored the bonus content, you probably should. There's bonus content in these courses, as it gets added. I do not raise the price of the course. I do not hold it only for new sales or anything. It just gets added. And sometimes we announce it, sometimes we forget to. But one of the objections I've heard to bioreactors is that since it takes a year, that's a long time to wait. Yeah, it is. You could make some fast compost and use it in the interim while you're making your first bioreactor. But what if you made a couple bioreactors every year, but you made them about right now? So by the time we got into April-ish, March, end of March, beginning of April, somewhere in that, you could actually do some of your gardening in your bioreactor, and that would actually make the compost better. I'll give you more on that when we get to the last one on the list. Next is forced air static pile. This is where you use a blower, a fan, something. You do static pile, just like I said, but a certain number of times a day, you're forcing air through it. This just keeps it more oxygen rich, less anaerobes. It's a great way to go. I've seen people find like blowers for sale that like inflate the wacky flailing arm guys and other things like that. Sometimes you can find that stuff on Craigslist, Facebook Marketplace. It's definitely worth considering. The people who I've seen trial it have not noticed much of a difference in the speed of the compost breakdown process. What I haven't seen many people do, though, is do two piles, same size, same dimension, same material, same add schedule, whether it's all at once, whether it's continuous add, whatever it is, just a control and experimental. One side is air-based, and one side is just left static to its own self. I've seen them do it right up to that point, and then they look at the compost, say, it looks the same. Okay, great. What I haven't seen any of them do is take a sample of each and send it out for a metagenomic analysis and see what the biology is going on there. My feelings is you'd have more of the good guys by providing that oxygen flow rate, unless you did a really good design of passive flow like we do in the bioreactor. Next is effective microorganism compost, also known as bokashi. Bokashi is where we'll use something like a rice bran along with EM, effective microbes. You put it in a bucket, and it's generally seen as what you do with all your food waste that can't go in the other composting methods, which is basically meat and dairy. This is probably why I haven't done much bokashi. I don't have meat waste. I don't have dairy waste. I don't understand what meat and dairy waste are. The most we'll ever have for some dairy waste is, you know, you get a little mold on the cheese, so you cut that piece off. I throw that in regular compost. There's not enough of it for me to bokashi. But plenty of people are using bokashi, and they're using the things that could go on the other compost to get very, very good results. And that's usually, once the bokashi's done, it's usually buried like a direct trench method in the garden, like I started off with, which is why I held it kind of to the end, or it goes into another composting method. And it's more like a formal pickling, like an anaerobic pickle. You know, when we make sauerkraut, you're kind of doing that. It's not exactly the same, but it's what you're kind of doing. People process human waste with this, and it's not a bad way to go. And by the way, biochar can go in any of these things, but it really, really helps with bokashi. But that's all I'll say on bokashi right now because I have the least amount of experience with it. But I also think that one of the real benefits to bokashi would be using the liquid from it to inoculate another form of compost. I think it would be really outstanding, and I'll save my thoughts on that for later. The last one is bioreactor compost invented by Dr. Stephen Johnson and his wife. And it is, of course, my preferred method because it's one I built a course on. And bioreactor composting, there's a lot of different designs, and almost all of them are good. Not all of them are good, but almost all of them accomplish the primary goal, and that is get all the material nice and wet, mixed well, nitrogen-carbon ratio somewhere in that 80-20-90-10 range, very, very wet when they're first added, get it in place, make sure nothing's more than a foot or maximum 18 inches from a place that air can get in, have a passive airflow so that air can flow through the system, and then somehow cap the top. Dr. Johnson does that using weed blocker. I use it with about a 4-inch deep bed of aged wood chips because I have a huge fungal kick. And then don't do anything except keep it moist as it needs to be for a year. It's one of the hardest things for humans to do is nothing. Now, it's very easy for us to do nothing when we don't want or care about the thing that we should care about. Like, it's easy for us to do nothing when we really need to be getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning and doing a 30-minute workout before we take a shower and get to work. That's easy to do nothing. But when it's something we want, It's very hard for us to do nothing. But that is the key to bioreactor. Nothing. It is, I almost don't like the term bioreactor. I think there are ways that these two terms can both be confusing. Bioreactor, there's a lot of bioreactors that have nothing to do with compost. You can look it up. And there's also biodigesters that also produce compost, but that's not the purpose. They're generally, a biodigester's purpose is usually to produce gas, and that gas can then be harnessed and used as fuel. But the more accurate term for a bioreactor would be a biodigester. This year, as an experiment and to save space, I took two half-done bioreactors and combined them into one bioreactor together. So they both went into a – so I didn't put one on top of the other. I took both of them and mixed them together into a new one to see where we're at about 5 months into the process. It looked like the rumen out of a cow's stomach. And probably like the second to the third stomach, not the first one, is what it looked like. It smelled like it, which doesn't smell good, but it doesn't smell bad either. It's hard to explain. Like, you're not like, oh, I want that scent on my body. But you're like, oh, my God, I can't believe that. I got to run away. It's somewhere in between those two extremes. But it is a digestive process. It's a, and all composting really is. But this is really like a long, slow digestion. And it's a digestion by fungi, by bacteria, by other microorganisms that aren't really one or the other. And it's also a digestion by worms, because these things, if you do them right, even if you don't seed them with worms, they'll probably end up with worms in them. But if you seed them with some worms after the thermophilic cycle, they become a giant, like 2 cubic yard worm farm in the best way possible. So those are your methods, and it's up to you what you want to do. There's people that think, because I am so sold on bioreactor compost, that I have like an aversion to other methods. I do not. I think they all serve a purpose based on your system, your homestead, your goals, your waste stream, how much of it you get at any one time. Like, bioreactor compost makes a ton of sense if you keep chickens and use a deep litter method and you have to muck out your coop once or twice a year. And whenever you muck it out, you're getting, you know, enough to make 2 to 3 bioreactors. I don't really know a better thing to do if that's you. But what if you don't have that? What if you have a little chicken coop? What if when you muck out your compost, your litter out of your chicken coop, you have enough to fill a garbage can? You can make a mini bioreactor. There's a bunch of other stuff you can do, right? If you don't use deep litter and you use a smaller coop, and every time you break it out, you're looking at like a third of a garbage can. You can feed that to soldier flies. So you see what I'm saying? Like, I'm not going to tell somebody they're wrong. The reason I recommend bioreactor composting is because I've looked at the test results of every method. And the one with the greatest number of beneficial bacteria and fungi, both in total population and in diversity, is bioreactor compost. And because I don't like to use the term lazy, because I do not consider myself a lazy person. I actually used in one of the videos I did about this years ago, I said lazy man compost once a year, ducks do all the work. That's clickbait. I work my ass off all the time, but I don't like to be the person working their ass off just so they can say they work their ass off. Like, I want my work to have meaning. And if I can do something really, really well, if I can actually get the best end result with the least amount of work, it's not that I'm lazy. It's that now that energy, Andy here is saying energy efficient, that energy can now be efficiently used on something else. That also, because if you run a homestead, you're always like, I need to do this. Like, right now, I'm like, man, I got to get my planning together for my winter period when I don't have all this other shit going on. And I don't know how, and I always feel that way every year. I don't know how I'm going to get it all done. I'm going to have to prioritize what's most important this year and do it in that order. Well, if I'm out there turning compost, it's one more thing to do. When people are like, Jack, why don't you keep rabbits? Because it's one more thing to do, and my wife won't eat the rabbits. Why'd you stop doing quail? Because it's one more thing to do, and my wife won't eat the quail. I'm going to do the things that give us the biggest bang out for energy in, and that's one of the reasons I love bioreactor compost. Now, integration into your daily life. I want to talk about that from a standpoint. I'll tell you what – well, I want to talk about biochar first real quick. And you guys know me. I'm like a fiend on this. Some people are like, all this guy does is talk about biochar. You know, like, if you get sick, rub some biochar on it or whatever. it just really is one of those products that has so many ways that it can be utilized. And it's something that anybody can make. If you have a Weber kettle grill, you can make biochar, right? I mean, it's, and you can find a wood waste stream, which anybody can. I sent out an email 2 weeks ago. I hit up two cabinet makers that are within 5 miles of me each. One came back and said, sure, I'll save all the scraps you want for you. He's going to put them in those big blue 55-gallon drums. I'm going to go pick two or three up at a time, bring him empty ones, and he's just going to keep filling them up and let me know whenever he has it, right? So anyone can tie into a waste stream of something. You can have brush. I guarantee you there's a waste stream, and so you can make it. I won't get into the whole spiel about it today. I just want to say this. I've looked at enough research now to know this is a fact. I don't care what method of composting you do. When you include biochar at the beginning, not just at the end, but at the beginning of that compost, you get better compost, you get more biological activity, you get more stable biological activity, you get a compost pile that dries out a lot slower than if it doesn't have it, especially as the compost matures, because what you usually find is compost is really good about holding moisture until a lot of that absorptive carbon begins to truly break down, and then it dries out much faster. And the whole process moves faster. Your biology moves quicker when we include compost. And the higher we throw, and the higher we throw the biochar in the system, the more that that's true. So if we're feeding biochar to the ducks and the chickens or whatever shitting on the bedding, and we're putting biochar in the bedding, and then that is a once or twice a year process of taking the bedding to compost, that compost has now already been in the process for 6 months to a year, at least the oldest ad has. And now it's going to go through a composting process that's going to be a few months to a year itself. We have a very mature, very well-aged product that has got these beautiful little houses for the microbes to live in, a great water reserve, which is good for everything, and the plant roots literally will penetrate into the porosity of biochar and kind of set up shop their interaction with microorganisms, and able to then draw water out when the soil's water level is actually somewhat low, but the char is still holding on to moisture. So I encourage you to use it one way or another in your composting process. We take the really fine stuff. I keep a jar next to the worm farm. I add stuff to the worm farm. Anyway, I'll get to that. Let's just go through it. So number one, all waste in our kitchen, with very few exceptions, either goes to the worms, the pit for the birds to pick through. One of those two, or gets fed to a dog, which is kind of another way of recycling it out, right? That's what I say. I don't do bokashi because meat waste. What's meat waste? You got your bones, and that's bone stock. Well, after that, you still got your bones. Maybe the dogs, like, we boil it so long that you can just, the dogs eat that. So I just don't have it. So usually, though, we're talking worms or a pit. My pit is nothing but some old cinder blocks made into a big square. It's about 4 foot by 4 foot. And anything that doesn't go to the worms goes in the pit. The birds go through it. All the straw they kick out of the coop when it gets wet, I rake it up with the pitchfork, 10-time manure fork, and I throw it in the pit. And anything yard waste that's shredded, every once in a while, if they really dig it out a lot, I go over to my wood chip pile and I take a wheelbarrow load of wood chips and throw it in there. It's just a continuous compost that's also rooted through by chickens and ducks and geese. And occasionally dogs, right? If you put something in there the dog wanted, like, I don't know, a paper towel with some grease on it, the dog digs it up and eats the paper towel, whatever. Then when it comes to, well, what goes to the worms? The best scraps. The least stinky stuff, right? The coffee grinds and stuff like that, they go to the worms. And I only want to feed the worms so much. So we produce quite a bit of material, especially from like right now, I've got a ton of beds and stuff I need to go chop material out of. Some will get chopped and dropped, but a lot of it will go in that pit. And so that's not all going to fit in a worm farm. I'm just not going to do that. Biochar goes in the collection containers, not just in the pit, not just in the litter, not just in the worm bin. So, you know, we had all these different ways that we handled compostables on the countertop. My wife bought this little thing. It looked like a little waste basket with a lid on it. And had a carbon filter in it and shit. And, you know, the lid eventually didn't quite close tight enough. And then flies go in there. And all we did, we went to is just a Tupperware with a lid that snaps on. And I keep a jar of biochar for that. And when you open it up, it's starting to have any odor or anything. A tablespoon or two goes in there. And that way, now it's as high as possible in the system. It's part of the whole composting process. It's into the pit or into the worms. The pit eventually goes into a bioreactor with the coop waste. So that's something I wanted to let you guys know. I am probably going to do a composting course, like a half-day course, more like an all-day course, like 6-7 hours hanging out here for locals only, really. I mean, anybody's welcome to come. It's going to be in January. And what that means is we could say it's going to be the second weekend of January, and then we could look at the forecast, and it could say like 7 below 0, and be like, no, screw that. We're not doing that. So we'll get at least one good weekend in January. We always do, just so you know. And if you want to make sure that you get invited to that and you're hearing this today and you might miss it in between now and then, send me an email, TSPC Compost in the subject line, and I'll let you know. Before anybody asks, if you don't know, I live in North Central Texas on the Fort Worth side of the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. That's you know, and I live near a place called Azle and a place called Lake Worth. I'm kind of in between the two of them. I'm not going to give out my exact address here in a live stream, but I am north of Lake Worth and south of Azle. If you want to see if it's going to work for you, just know, and this is why you might want to be on an alert list for it, I might say it's this weekend, and then when we get close enough for a 10-day forecast to be accurate, go, hey, we were going to move it to the next week, right? And that's why I say locals only, because I wouldn't buy an airplane ticket for this myself, but I would feel really bad if somebody did and then it got moved, just so you're aware. Anyway, we're going to do that, and we'll be doing some stuff with biochar and stuff too, and we always make it a good time, and I always charge like $20-25, enough to feed you guys, basically, and feed you really well. That's pretty much all we charge for doing those. Anyway, once we have that going on, we're going to eventually make a bioreactor. But before we do, every time I put a bale or two of straw or a couple wheelbarrows full of wood chips in the duck house, right, so it's layered like lasagna, when that thing's totally cleaned out, I put down at least a 5-gallon bucket of biochar, and then the first layer of litter goes on top of it. The ducks do what they do. The chickens do what they do. They dig through it. They eat some of the char. They shit on it. And eventually, it's like starting to smell a little bit. Another bucket of biochar goes down and another layer of dry litter. And so every layer of dry litter gets lasagna'd like that all the way up. Okay? Then when we take compost out of the bioreactor, because we need the space to make another bioreactor, I now have something, and I said you should, if you take the course, go look at the bonus material. I've designed what I call an aging reactor, which is basically a simplified form of bioreactor just so the compost stays good. So we take as much compost from the bioreactor we're going to use right away, the stuff we're going to keep for a while, let it continue to age like fine wine. It goes in the aging reactor, and that's just basically a big central cage with weed fabric around it and a large cage. So it's got so it has no more than about 2 foot between the two. So again, you can get airflow, and when that stays wet, we keep wood chips on it. And again, you can garden in that too, and you actually increase the value of the compost by the reaction with the plant roots. I think people think that like when you start using it, it goes downhill. Not if you do it right. That compost is used in teas, extract, as bed toppings and dressing to make potting soils. With all the biochar that's in it, you'd think that's good enough. No, when I make potting soil, I add about 10% by volume. So if I put 20 big scoops of compost into a Rubbermaid tub for my potting soil, you know, then I'll put in 1 or 2 scoops of biochar. And then I put in about 1/2 scoop of perlite. And I put the perlite in just so when I mix it, I can see I got an even mixture. Because when you put biochar into compost, you can't see it anymore. I mean, if you get really close, you can, but you can't tell that it's distributed well. So I have 2 big-ass bags of perlite that I got super cheap, and I'll probably never run out of it. And it's so inexpensive and so easy, and it is a nice, lightener, fluffier thing, so that you know you got a good mix with it. If you have a compost tumbler and you're kind of past that phase of using it for making compost, don't get rid of it. Use it to mix your potting soil. And then, you know, it opens and it dumps right into a bucket or whatever. So it's kind of cool. I've been keeping an eye out for somebody getting rid of one, because if they are, I'm going to go pick it up. And then that way I'll use it to mix my potting soil every year. It's kind of a cool way to go. When you make your potting soil, make sure that you keep it moist. And just because you sealed it in a tub or something doesn't mean it's going to stay moist. At least every couple of weeks, you should probably open it up, get some airflow in it, and give it a little light watering and give it a little bit of a fluff. And that's why I kind of make it as I need it. I don't want to store it long term. Probably everybody here has bought a bag of potting soil and forgot about it, and you rolled it up and you thought it was good and you put it in the back and you went and you picked it up and it was like balsa wood, super light. And it's pretty much, you pretty much should just throw it in a compost pile now. It's pretty much just organic matter. You'll never bring it back to life. If it was, you know, a biological good quality mix in the first place, you've now got inert matter. Even the dogs get char in their food a few times a week. So a few times a week, we'll throw a teaspoon or a tablespoon of very fine ground biochar in the dog's food. That way their waste product is actually distributing inoculated biochar. So everything is part of the compost process then. I have a suggestion for some of you that are cat owners that, unlike me, you know, how you have house cats. We have a barn cat, Fox. He gets to come in the morning sometimes for a snack and a pet. Since he lost his sister, B. Hendrix's biochars are less stinky. I bet. You bet. You bet. The dogs stink less. The birds stink less. The coops stink. Everything stinks less. It just works that way. But, you know, since he lost his sister, we lost Dana, his sister, this summer to a weird thing where something penetrated her chest wall, and she got some sort of bacterial infection in her lungs. And she lost a little bit of weight, and we were starting to worry about her, and then she really crashed, and we took her to the vet, and the vet said, if you brought her here 2 weeks earlier, the end result would have been the same. You'd have lost her, or you'd have spent a fortune trying to save her and probably still lost her. It's just a weird thing that happens. But so he lost her. So we let her in the house a little bit more to be pet and all, because he doesn't have a friend anymore. So we feel bad for him and all. But we don't have, you know, the only time he gets a litter box is when it's going to be like 14 degrees out and we have him in overnight and he stays in the pantry, basically, in the washroom. But if you do have a cat that uses a litter box, the most environmentally friendly product you can use is called feline pine or some version thereof. And it's basically just pine sawdust. The problem is, no matter how much people vouch for it, cat shit stinks and cat piss stinks. And without anything extra there to do anything about it, it stinks really bad, unless you are like the person that hyper cleans your cat box like once, maybe twice a day. If you have more than one cat, twice a day. If you put, I haven't tested this yet, but I have a feeling that if you put about 15% by volume biochar in your cat litter, that stink will just go away. And then you have a perfect compost medium, but you need to treat it like human manure. A cat is an omnivore. A cat's poop is nasty. It's not. It's way nastier than a cow's or a chicken's or a rabbit's. But 1 year in a bioreactor, you'll be okay. Anything that's a year or more, it will be okay. So now I want to talk to you about a few that I don't do yet or all the time, but I kind of want to play with more. One is the BSLs. I'm going to do that this year. It's just been a matter of, I honestly don't have enough waste stream to really get them, keep them going. So I think I'm going to talk to like some coffee houses or something about procuring a waste stream for them, because the beauty of BSL is you don't just get this amazing compost. You get free food for your livestock. Chickens, ducks, fish, love these things. Quail eat the hell out of them too. They can be fed while they're still alive and they're just pupated. They can be fed after they've been frozen. They can be fed after they've been dehydrated. So they can become a storable feed source, high in protein, high in fat, and it can really cut your feed bill. I told you I don't do Bokashi. I don't have the waste stream for it. And I don't know that I'll do Bokashi. I do want to start infusing things like Lab, EM, maybe a little bit of Bokashi into my other composting methods, because I believe that can only improve the results. Okay. So lab is lactic acid bacteria. I actually do this already. Sometimes it's a byproduct. You know, sometimes we make some cheese or something and we have this whey that's basically lab, and I'll just dump that onto my compost piles. But what I really feel that I should be doing is lab or EM would be a great addition to a bioreactor when it's almost done. Let's say 10 months or more into the process. It's kind of a thing to kick the end and to finish off really strong. And I should really kind of set reminders that say, hey, this pile was made on January 15th, you know, 6:15. You need to give it, you know, this, and maybe, you know, November, give it a lab infusion or something like that. And it's just something that I haven't done as well. Peter here says VSL like brewer's grain too. I feed the grain and VSLs directly to my chickens. That's a great idea. And there is a lot of brewers and distillers around here to get grain from. That's actually a really great idea. And one of the really great things about brewer's grains or distiller's grains is after they've been extracted, what are we making ethyl alcohol with? Sugar. Okay. So when you extract the sugar so you can make the alcohol, what you leave behind, there's really not much fat in a grain, but there is protein. So it's not a high protein by weight, but the percentage is much higher because you've extracted the sugars. So it's a great protein kicker to your livestock as well. So thanks for that there, Peter. Moving on, I just want, in the end, with composting, to repeat something that I said at the very end of the composting course. And if those of you who have taken it, you'll recognize it when I say it. Be fearless and make compost. Man has been composting waste for about as long as man has understood that waste can be composted. And if we take the end product and put it on plants, they grow better. You know, the same thing with biochar, right? Like, well, it's got to be crushed into a minimum 1/8. Do you think the people that made Terra Preta were out there like screening their freaking biochar? Yes, we can accelerate processes by doing things at a higher level, but it doesn't mean that if you don't do it exactly right, like God's going to smite you with his thumb and electrocute you with a lightning bolt because you made compost wrong, or all your chickens will die because your biochar was too big, right? Or, you know, all your tomatoes will be evaporated by space aliens because your compost wasn't turned exactly on the day it was supposed to be turned, or whatever bullshit somebody comes up with in their head. And I find that in our space, there's a lot of people who, when they discover something new and they've never done it before, they really want to understand it before they do it. This is why I make courses. I want you to understand it too. But I would rather you go ahead and do it, and then you can improve your results over time, than to sit around and wait till I know everything. Because you're not going to know everything, even about something as simple as compost. I have studied compost making from a scientific level for at least a decade. I made my first compost with my grandfather out of horseshit, leaves, and grass clippings when I was 8 years old. And like unlike a lot of people would say, well, I did this when I was a kid. Like, I actually thought it was cool, so I paid attention. You know, and by the time I was 10, when I would go on vacation to my grandfather's, he'd be like, go make the compost. The neighbor just brought over a load of horse shit. And I would do it myself. So I've been doing this almost my whole life. I will still learn something new about it before the year ends, and we're almost to Christmas. You'll never know everything. Do what Richard's saying here. Get shit done, you know? That's really what you want to do. Just go out and make things happen. So I'm going to answer some questions now. And if you have a question and you don't see it come up, I got five. A question or comment that don't show up, you know, hey, Alabama got lucky here. Used could you in all caps. We didn't say question in all caps, but I saw it anyway. Question, the word question in all caps. Then your question, one sentence for your question. If you feel you need details, you can add them from there. Well, let's go ahead and hit these. Wait, that's banners. I don't need banners. Comments. Start. Okay. Monday, guys. Okay, weathered soul. This is a long one. According to a recent guest, you should need very little composted material to affect your soil, and the applications of teas and extracts should be enough to inoculate your soil. Yes, from that standpoint. you can use a 5-gallon bucket of compost to make enough extract for an acre. That is true. However, how many applications are you going to do a year? And if you're making a lot of compost, why wouldn't you like top dress your garden beds a couple inches every year and keep building the organic matter at a higher level? So there's need, right? You need a certain amount of protein and fat every day or you will die. That's your need. There's a base level need. There's a certain amount of protein. And if a human being consumes less than an amount for long enough, their metabolic functions will begin to decline and eventually it will kill them. The same for fat. By the way, for you high carb folks, there is no minimum amount of carbohydrate required for human beings. A human being can go their entire life, never touch a carbohydrate other than maybe in mother's milk as a baby, and have no ill effects whatsoever. But there's a minimum. That doesn't mean it's optimum. If you go to the doctor and you get a test for something like your vitamin D levels, you're above the minimum. You're above 30 parts per hundred or whatever, thousand or nanoliter, 30 parts per nanoliter of your blood. So you have enough. You're also one away, 29 is considered low. But what's optimum? It's probably somewhere between 80 and 120, even though a doctor will tell you at 100, it's too high. No, shut up. You don't know the history of vitamin D. So I liken compost to be like there's a minimum level to get a good result. And then there's an optimum result. And to me, the more we're making, the more we can do. The more we can spread, the more we can make into teas and extracts. So I don't know if that really answers your question. If you want me to say more on it, get it in before I finish up today. Also, weathered soul, how cold is too cold for a worm bin? If it freezes, they're going to die. So 32, right, is too cold. I try to keep my shop from ever freezing up, and I have never had worms die because they were cold in my shop. I've never had everything freeze solid in my shop. The one exception was the one year where the power went out and we had a multi-day below 10 degree for the high. We had almost a week where it never got above 10 degrees for the high, and we had a lot of nights below zero, and the power went out for several days. And when it came to making decisions about what to keep warm, the shop was not that important. It was a little portable heater by the water system so that it didn't freeze up, and generators running other things. Other than that, we've never had a problem with it. So when it comes to bioreactor compost, you never want it to freeze solid. And Steven Reisner gave me a great idea. I've never had to do this. I've also never had a bioreactor. It's a pretty big chunk of soil freeze solid through. If anything's not frozen, you have a battery of your reserve biology. And biology goes through freezes in the soil too. Except if it's in the soil below grade, you know, your soil only freezes so deep, but this is a normal occurrence. But if you really want to optimize it, what Steven said to do is get yourself like a big aquarium heater, like something for a 50 or 75 gallon tank, set it on its lowest setting, shove it down in the middle of the compost pile and plug it in. It'll only kick on when it gets colder than that temperature. And when it goes above that temperature, it'll kick off. So it won't start a fire or nothing. I can't guarantee you 100%. That everything he said is true about it not being any kind of safety risk, but I have a hard time seeing how it would be. It's wet. It's an aquarium heater. They go in water. I'm looking at one right now. It's not catching on fire. So that should be good. Now, the thing about any kind of heater is that it can go sideways on you. So it's something you probably want to keep. And what I mean is it's never happened to me. I've seen people in like aquarium groups and stuff say my heater ran away and it basically killed all my fish. Like I had it set for like 72 degrees or 74 degrees and I came home and my fish were dead and the water was warm to the touch. And when I measured it, it was like 120 degree water. Again, I've never seen it in real life, but I've heard reports of it. So just I'll temper that one with a little bit of extra information. Matthew says, the Wyoming wind carried an insane amount of tumbleweeds in last night. Common occurrence. Isn't it best to hot compost them rather than a bioreactor to kill the seeds? So if you put them in a bioreactor, you will get a very serious, very high as long as you have enough nitrogen, thermophilic cycle. And it will roast the seeds. It may not get the ones that are right out at the edge with that, but it will mostly incinerate them. Then, when that thermophilic cycle ends, the biological activity, any seed that sits there dormant for any amount of time is probably going to get consumed by microorganisms themselves. Microorganisms will eat seeds, right? And then, you know, you're going to cap with wood chips. Any that don't get incinerated are probably going to grow up through the wood chips and be very, like, whenever I see anything poke up through my wood chips, unless it's something I planted in there, I just pull it out with my fingers. It takes a couple seconds a day to go by. You should check your bioreactors. Even if you automate the water, you should check them every day. Just look at them and make sure nothing bad's happened. Nothing's going wrong. Especially if you automate watering. One of the reasons I like to manually water my compost piles is because I have to do it every day. And when you automate things, you have a tendency to go, ah, that's fine. And then you go back and it's completely dried out and it hasn't been working for 3 weeks and you didn't know it. So unless you have some sort of monitoring equipment in your automation, you want to be checking it every day as well. And so that's what I would say. But if you want to hot compost just those with some nitrogen, because they're all carbon, and then take that resulting compost and add it to your bioreactors later, there's nothing wrong with that either. Nothing wrong with that either. JD Drafts doesn't have anything to say, but he gave me a $4.99 super chat. Thank you, sir. I appreciate it a great deal when anybody ever supports me in any way, shape, or form. Hey, hey, Alabama said, could you use grains and soak them yourself for a while in buckets? So if you're feeding grain to your livestock, and you're soaking it, you need to be soaking it in a way, and you need to look up how to do it because I don't have time to cover it today, where you're fermenting it and not alcohol fermenting, lactobacillus fermentation, right? This is where you're basically, again, it's like making sauerkraut, only a little bit different. And here's why. If you just soak grain in water, you don't really, now soaking grain for a while before you feeding it, that's helpful. You're going to get some fermentation because there is lactobacillus everywhere, but you're not getting it's not the same. You're not getting a carbohydrate extraction. If you ferment it, then your fermenting bacteria are going to break down, and this is why fermenting feed is very helpful, going to break down those carbohydrates and leave you a higher protein yield. But if it doesn't ferment, if all it does is soak, you just got soaked grain. The extraction process when you brew or you distill, and you don't use an extract, you use a whole grain, there's a temperature and there's a time that we hold this at in what's known as a mashing process. And then we then extract that liquid wort if we're a brewer. I don't even know what you call it. I made a lot of moonshine, but I always just call it wort because that's what we call it when we make beer. You extract that, and then you ferment that with a yeast that is an alcohol-producing yeast, but rather than a lacto-fermentation. And then that is either carbonated in its beer, or it is distilled to up the alcohol, and it is, you know, a whiskey or something like that, depending on what you do with it after you distill it. Essentially, it's all, when it first comes out, a form of vodka or brandy, depending on what you started with. But if it's grain, it's basically vodka when it first comes out, unless you push it through something like a gin basket, and then it's gin, which is vodka flavored with stuff, right? So that's the deal there. The real reason, though, to use distiller's grain, or if you use a beer brewer's grain, is they'll give it to you for free. They'll give it to you for free. So you're taking a waste product. And you know, the other thing is you can feed that to black soldier fly. Like the one guy said, you could feed that to worms. You can compost it. Like if you don't have livestock and you can get into that waste stream, it's a fantastic compost. And protein is a good thing in compost, by the way. We don't talk about it much. Weathered Soul threw me $5 and says, thanks, Jack. The cover crop classes are great. I'm glad you enjoyed them. I had some really great feedback from Billy Bond on the cover crop course. What he said, and again, he said this to his live audience while he was interviewing me. He said he learned more in my cover crop course Then he learned in Elaine Ingham's $4,500 soils course. But he couched that with a practical application to a person that's actually just trying to grow more food. He's like, and I learned more in the first two chapters of it than of practical application than I did in a $4,500 course from Elaine Ingham. I'm not putting myself on level with Elaine as a scientist, as a researcher, whatever. But I think the reason my courses are so well received is I teach like a military person. And I don't mean basic where they yell at you all the time and tell you if you don't get it done in 90 seconds, you're going to die. I'm talking about when you have to educate soldiers, you have people of varying intellect and capability. I'm talking about the training after the basic. And things have to be condensed down to consumable amounts into the things that actually matter and not a lot of fluff and hype and bullshit that's not important. And I think that's why it comes out that way. Lynn has a question for me too here. Does residential grass clippings that have been sprayed for weeds still work in a composter? I would not. I think there's plenty of waste streams other than that. In the end, if you do it right with many herbicides, the composting process itself will break down and lock up what's left of these residues. But if you don't know it, so for me, like if something had been sprayed with some Roundup and it hasn't been composted yet and it's going to be in compost with other things, I'm not real worried about it. Roundup just exposed to UV light is basically broken down to nothing in about 6 months. It's when it gets up into plants that's really a problem. Then it's in a little safe little place to hide until you eat it. I don't want it, but I'm less worried about it. There are some things that like True Green, Chemlong companies and whatnot spray that have half-lives measured in years. And if you're using a major component of your compost from that, I think you're really risking ending up with a persistent herbicide residue at the end, and then you're actually putting that in your garden, and it might take a very long time to get rid of it. So I do not recommend, you know, any product that's been routinely sprayed. I think it's just a bad idea overall. I think that's all I got. Lion's Den says, break it down Barney style. That is what we used to say in the art. Well, you know, that's actually one I really kind of missed. Break it down Barney style. I know of it from my military friends, but I got out of the Army in 1993, and Barney wasn't really a thing yet. It hadn't really, the purple dinosaur had not risen to the top of the children's thing. But yeah, that is a military saying, because it's very much what you have to do. You have to break it down to where anybody can understand it, and then you have to give it to them in a way that they can put it to use. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and wrap up. I want to remind you guys that you can help support this show, especially this time of year when you're doing lots of shopping anyway, by just beginning your shopping at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. If you go there, and if you just click one of the main links to get over to Vavor or Amazon, no matter what you buy, you'll support us. It doesn't cost you any extra money to do it. If it's a Vavor product, you get my discount code when you do it and save 5% off. So you actually save money by doing it and help us out. Today's item of the day is the same one that I ended last week with, Vavor's Conical Burr Coffee Grinder. I love this thing, and I wanted you guys to know, if you want to see it work, I added a video to the review this morning. So you can check out and see it actually in action and work. It's a really great item, and I think anybody that really likes coffee, if they don't already have a great grinder, would love this. And they're about $70, I think, from my memory. And, man, this thing just works. It's very intuitive if you watch the video. You don't have to have, like, an engineering degree to use it or anything like that. But I want to hit you with a couple items that we brought up recently that have done really well since we are near Christmas. The Hamilton Beach 3-in-1 egg cooker. This thing is awesome as well. I've been eating so many deviled eggs, I'm probably going to fart myself into the atmosphere or something. But, man, I love deviled eggs. I love boiled eggs. I love soft-boiled eggs in like a beef soup or something like that. This just works perfectly. It's all about how much water you add. I did just find one of the little hole poker things, as the way I described last week. Somebody emailed me and said that they had a similar product that had a hole poker at the bottom of the water cup. The Hamilton Beach one doesn't. I picked them up for like $8. I haven't used it yet. I did add a link in case you want to know what I picked out. And then the Olietta stainless steel olive oil bottle. this thing's great too. It's just designed the way that you look at this when you get it in your hands and you say to yourself, why in the world do they not do all olive oil dispenser bottles the way this thing is done? Nothing spills. You don't need a funnel to fill it. It's small, it's light, and it's indestructible. So when you knock it off the counter, like I have many times, it won't break. Real quick, before I completely wrap up, Amy B. threw me $21 blackjack in a super chat. Thank you, Amy. And that's a question. And the question is, what to do with sprayed straw on my property? Burn? Question mark. Maybe. If I you can follow up for me here, Amy, while I'm answering this, and let me know, is this because you're buying straw for litter and the only source you can get you suspect or know is sprayed, or are you spraying your straw because you're running a farm operation? I'm not really sure, but I would say the first thing is try to get a source. If you're buying in straw bales that are sprayed bales, try to get one that isn't. And then what is sprayed on it, when and how much? Usually if you're dealing with wheat or barley straw or something like that that doesn't have a GMO that's designed to be sprayed with an herbicide, it's either sprayed with something that doesn't kill grass, like a broadleaf. Some of those are really bad. Some of those are not so bad. So finding out the source and what it's sprayed with would be part of it. If it is a glyphosate spray, which a lot of wheat, barley, et cetera, what they do is they actually spray it right before harvest one time. And they use, actually, when they do this, I don't like it because it ends up in your food supply. But they use a very small amount. It's just the it's, you know, wheat, all these grains are grasses. And they're right at the edge of going dormant anyway. And all they're doing is accelerating that process. That usually, by the time it gets harvested, sent to you, there's been a lot of breakdown already by the time it goes through cooping and used as it like breaks down a lot. And then by the time you put it, especially if you're bioreactor composting it. So what I tell people to do is the bucket watering bean test. So take two pots and plant a bean in each one, or a couple beans in each one. One's your control, one's your experimental. Take your straw, put it in a 5-gallon bucket and soak it in the water overnight. Pull it out and then water one bean pot with that water and one with clean water. And if both of them grow about the same, I don't care what it was sprayed with, it's not going to be a problem. If it doesn't fuck up a legume, it's going to be okay. Especially once it goes through the compost. If you get one side growing all nice and pretty, use the same soil, obviously. If it comes out of a bag, soil from the same bag. If you make it, whatever, right? And if you have one that's growing like all, like its growth is all retarded and jacked up, it's yellowing, it's looking gnarly and unhappy, and the other one's all happy, you've got something in there that you really don't want to use. And that's my purchased without a surety that it's unsprayed. Yeah, okay, so Amy says she bought it, but she doesn't know if it's been sprayed or not. They don't know. And okay, that's an honest supplier. My supplier's that way too. We don't know when I first started buying from them. Every time I buy some bales, I give it that test before it goes in the coop. Because once it's in the coop, there's not much I can do. I have yet to have any straw that I've bought from these people up here fail that test. And I think that for all the good Paul Wheaton has done, I think Paul Wheaton has got enough influence that he has caused confusion and concern beyond what is necessary here, that the thing you do to remediate soil that's been so heavily saturated with this stuff is to put really good compost tea on it. And if we're making it into compost, what's going to come out in the end product, unless it is really toxic, there's really a lot of it, and it's your primary feedstock, it's going to be okay. So give it the bean test. And she says it's going to be basement beans. That's okay. That's fine. Just as long as they're going to, I don't care if they're in a sunny wind, as long as you have a control. Because you may get lackluster growth, but if it's the same, it's fine unless it's really shitty, and then you need to improve your growing conditions. With that, I am wrapped up and ready to be done for the day. I have an announcement, though. Tomorrow, if you're a Bitcoin person, I did see some Bitcoin chatter We just hit another all-time high. I think overnight it hit 106,000 of Bitcoin. And it's interesting, like all the maxis that have been cheering along, let's get to 100. Like, you have a $5,000 candle now. And I'm like, whatever. Like, we're not even going to start talking about it again until it's probably like $1.15 or $1.20 a coin. But Bitcoin is in that part of the cycle where it does things that everybody said it couldn't do. And then, you know, you get through that cycle and there's a retraction. And then they all talk shit again, and then it does it again. And I think what people need to understand, there's already people throwing some FUD out there, but it's the end of the year. Crypto winter always comes in winter. It always comes like in December, and that's why it's over. Yes, it comes in winter. That's why it's called crypto winter. And it comes in the post-halving year. In other words, Bitcoin halves, then you get all the way around to the next winter, and then you get the retraction. If you get a retraction, because things are different now. That means we got a year to go, boys and girls. And I had somebody reach out to me and say, hey, we haven't done anything for a long time. We should do a show together. And that guy is the guy that has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know, i.e. Guy Swan. So tomorrow we will have a new episode of TSB, but it will also be a BBO. And it will be Guy and I simulcasting to our own YouTube channels. So this should be really cool. They're probably, Michelle 1776 says it's 106,300 right now. So it's up from that. This morning it was like 102. Cool. It just keeps bouncing around. And like I said, you have $5,000 move and people are like, oh, whatever. Right? That's the old guard, man. That's the OGs in Bitcoin. Anyway, Guy is a man who I truly respect. When people say they've done their research on something, usually that means they haven't. They've talked to like the people that reinforce their bias. Guy is not bragging when he says he's the guy that read more about Bitcoin than anybody you know, because he's read everything. His whole podcast is reads. He's also done the audio for audiobooks for like the biggest names in Bitcoin. I'm listening to right now, and this would be another great suggestion for you guys as a book for yourselves or somebody that cares about economics, even if it's not cryptocurrency. Lynn Alden is an amazing woman, amazing pedigree in finance, and she's released a book called Broken Money. That book is awesome. I need to add it to T-Spaz. I don't know if it'll happen before the break, but it's fantastic. I'm doing the audio, and Guy's the reader, and I know Guy so well that I have to reinforce to myself when I'm like taking my morning walks and all, he's reading Lynn's book. It's not his opinion. It's not Guy's take. It's anyway, Guy's awesome. Tom says it almost hit 108 today already. Awesome. 110 is when people will start talking about it again, though. But Guy has recently re-released something that I love. You know the whole quadrant things? Well, he wrote the, how much do you give a shit? Right? How much do you give a fuck about money you're spending? And he broke it down into four classifications. I won't tell you what there are. I'll definitely ask him about it so we can talk about it tomorrow. But this is a great short to share with you. I'll make sure there's a link to it in the show notes tomorrow. With that, check out. Be fearless, make compost, and I'll catch you tomorrow. Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.